Hi, this is Mike Chapman, president of Springboard Strategy Brand. With me today to talk about how medical associations can lead through policy and economic pressures is John Ross, founder of Ross Consulting and JR Squared, also a member of Springboard Strategy faculty. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Mike, and I appreciate it. Good to see you, and I look forward to talking about this.
So, John, I'm really excited to talk to you today. I don't always draw a straight line between policy and the economy and the health of a medical association. But, you know, if you think about it further, and as we've discussed, the effect on the population, their effect on providers, the following effect then to the association is something that associations really should be paying attention to. Let's start with what's happening now. What are the policy and economic indicators that medical associations should be paying attention to?
That's a good question. I want to start by saying, Mike, that we're talking about policy and advocacy today, something that all medical associations do. But I think what we're talking about today is expanding those definitions and that practice of policy and advocacy in ways many associations don't typically think about. So I want to start off with that, because we're at a moment where there are some significant policy moves that are creating economic pressures that are stressing and will stress the market and the way healthcare is accessed and delivered. I think most people are familiar with the reconciliation bill Congress passed earlier this year, called the Big Beautiful Bill. Among other things, as it relates to our sector, it is going to cut $1 trillion out of Medicaid, Medicare, and food stamp programs. Why is that important to medical associations? Well, when you cut $1 trillion out of the largest sector, roughly 20% or more of a 20-plus trillion-dollar economy, and one that's responsible for roughly 1 in 6 jobs in this country, that's going to have a significant impact beyond healthcare access and care. It's going to create budget constraints that will trickle down to the state and local levels, Medicaid obviously being administered at the state level. It's going to have different effects, particular to each state, but they will be significant. It will create pressure on Medicaid and safety net funding. The word affordability has been tossed around a lot this year in an election year. I think it will be tossed around a lot going forward, the rest of this year and into the next presidential election, because we are at a time where the economy is flat, the job market is flat. Affordability is not a throwaway word. It's a real issue for a lot of people. And what we're starting to see, and what the markets are already responding to and anticipating, is that the $1 trillion in cuts that are coming are not just only affecting healthcare service delivery costs, reimbursement, equity, access, but they're affecting economies and jobs, because this is the largest job sector. And the healthcare and social services job sector was reliably growing for years, even before and through COVID, until February. The job market shrank by more than 90,000 jobs in February, and was revised for 2025, basically to indicate that the job market was flat. No net private sector employment. Of course, public sector employment led by the federal government dropped as well. But in that 92,000 job loss, 26,000 of those were in healthcare, and that's unusual. That had not happened in a while, and that may be a blip. We'll know better when the March numbers come out soon and all that, but I don't think it is. And I'm not an economist, so I'm not speaking as an economist, but those jobs in healthcare that were lost were in small practices, physician practices, small clinical operations, pharmacies, doctor's offices. And that's a sign that what a lot of people think the $1 trillion in cuts will mean is already happening, a consolidation of the smaller edges of the market, the folks in the more vulnerable markets, small towns, more rural, remote communities more dependent and reliant on Medicaid. Hospitals, typically in smaller communities, have higher proportions of their revenues tied to Medicaid. We've seen clinics shutting down already, small clinics, even in states that have expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. All these things are starting to happen early because markets and people who fund them, and providers and insurers and everybody who's part of the healthcare ecosystem, everybody is starting to anticipate this and act accordingly. And that is and should be a signal for folks in the medical association world, because the market is responding early, months and months before these budget cuts go into effect. They'll go into effect at the end of the year after the elections. And what that means is, and it's already happening, if you're a healthcare provider, you're going to have tighter budgets. Your local government partners, social services, healthcare, crime control, even in the justice system, are probably going to have to provide more services to more people with less money and with fewer jobs available because everything is constricting. And that means there's going to have to be more creative alignment between the folks who are providing medical and healthcare services and those who are providing other social services and even into the justice system and in police. Why? Because you're likely to, because fewer people are going to have adequate healthcare, more people are going to delay healthcare coverage or care because of affordability. They're making choices between feeding their kids and buying drugs or, you know, paying their rent and going to the doctor. You're going to likely see more people on the street. You're going to see more cases of chronic as opposed to acute illness. And those will be reflected in the clinicians and hospitals and other providers who are seeing folks. You'll probably see more cases, unfortunately, of drug use and substance use and overdose. And so the integration and interaction of the health and social services system with police, the people who are finding folks on the street and trying to expedite services and treatment for them, as opposed to throwing them in jail, for example, because that's not just not good for the people who are picked up for petty crimes or victimless crimes, but it costs more money for the system. Local and state governments are going to have to look at programs like this, and folks who are part of that ecosystem, doctors, clinicians, healthcare providers, et cetera, are going to be a part of that and are really going to need to find very creative ways to work more agilely, more creatively with others throughout the social service system and the social safety net. And there are going to be job cuts in healthcare. They were already seeing them. Some estimates from places like Commonwealth Fund, Kaiser Family Foundation, American Hospital Association project job cuts of several hundred thousand, even as many up to 1 million this year, before these budget cuts go into effect. And that's not just in healthcare jobs. The ancillary, the ripple in the pond jobs that are tied to healthcare, construction, manufacturing, the retail businesses, the restaurants, the shoeshine shops, the dry cleaners that rely on and locate near hospitals, healthcare facilities, and the people who work in them. There is likely to be constriction in those markets and those sectors that are tied to or you know, are dependent on healthcare. So the bottom line is going to be you got to do more with less for more people, probably with more partners and providers, where there's going to be less money with less access. Care might be delayed, more chronic cases, and more complex and costly patients. And I'm not trying to be a harbinger of bad news. Or a doomsayer. Again, I'm not an economist, but these are things that are already happening, and that the markets, including in communities, are already responding to and seeing. And so, for medical associations, this isn't background. It's not theoretical. It's being aware that this is the environment your members are operating in right now, and that it's rapidly changing. And the sooner you realize this and help them develop the tools and resources to adjust to it, the better off.
Let's connect this back to medical associations. Why should they prioritize these issues now?
Mike, that's a great question, and it really has to be addressed from several levels. One, if you're an association, your credibility and your existence rely on members and members being happy and paying dues, and their viability as well as yours is at stake. When their margins tighten and their practices become more challenged, less sustainable, especially if you have members with in smaller communities, smaller systems, more independence, etc., their viability threatens your viability. So you have to be very aware of that. And so you may see threats to your membership. You may receive demands and urgent ones for, we need more support. Why aren't you helping us with this? And a need or a plea for greater variation and flexibility in serving members so that you keep them happy and they stay stable. I mean, I don't know the data on what practices or members are do without when they're challenged financially, but you don't want to be at the top of the list of things they're going to cut when they're struggling with financial issues. You have to really demonstrate your value to them. Access, when they're dealing with issues of access in their communities, that also becomes a membership problem for you, because when care becomes less accessible, patients are going into fewer providers, whether they're individual clinicians, whether they're hospitals. We've seen consolidation of medical practices, consolidation of hospitals over the years. It's been steady. It's gone in different cycles over the years. I think we're going to see a more rapid cycle of that consolidation now, and that means wait times increase, care gaps widen, less time to spend with patients, longer working hours for you and your staff. And because money might be tighter, you might not be able to hire or find staff to do this kind of work. And there may be greater administrative and bureaucratic demands on you, given the way the federal government funding and reimbursement mechanisms are going, that will trickle down to the state and local level. So again, not to be a harbinger of bad news, but to access and viability of members and their practices and their day-to-day business are directly tied to the value you provide to them. They're dealing with higher demand, more pressure from all members of the ecosystem, starting at the government level, and greater complexity. And that means higher costs, more chronic cases, strain on the communities, and on the entire social system, the social services system and ecosystem we're all working in, which includes the workforce, which includes the greater economy, which includes things that you don't necessarily think about at an association level, but at the community level, your members do. And then on another issue, and this is where it really, I think, is much more personal, is the impact of policy becomes individualized and personal. If you have a significant Medicaid load, or public patient load as a hospital or as a provider, as a group practice, an individual practice, the policy changes around Medicaid, the reduction of food stamp payments to people and the qualifications to get in, are really going to affect your members. And that again can affect their welfare, the health of their practice. And so for you as their representative and their advocate to be aware of policy and economic issues that affect them, not only at the macro level, at the federal level, but at the state and local and community level, that means you're probably going to be partnering more and in different ways with your local and state affiliates, or create the kinds of partnerships with policy groups and advocacy groups and folks on the ground, locally and otherwise, who are knowledgeable, who can really help you and be good intermediaries, good bridges to the communities of the folks you're representing. And again, this requires creative partnerships in many cases for you as an association leader in working with and supporting and serving your individual members. Whatever they do, whether they're practitioners, whether they're hospitals, administrators, et cetera. So you really have to make the strategic decision fast to be aware of what's going on and how this is going to affect your members in all 50 states. And they're going to affect members differently in different states. Different states are filling in gaps differently in areas like Medicaid. If they have a mature ACA, expanded Medicaid operation, a lot of states are filling in gaps that the federal the loss of the tax subsidies, at least for the time being, has created. But in the states that haven't expanded ACA, and that's mostly states kind of in the southern tier, the plains, there are about only 10 or 11 states that haven't expanded. That's a really significant challenge, because it's going to be harder for folks to get onto Medicaid in the first place. It's going to be harder for people treating Medicaid patients, whether they're hospitals or clinicians, to get the money they need for that, to depend on the stability of revenue and reimbursement, et cetera. So, I mean, all this it's trickling down, and your job is to find ways to help your members minimize the effects of these policy changes.
John, you bring up a really good point. We're working with a medical association who's taken a really interesting look, I think, at advocacy. And the reason they are is their members came to them and said, you know what? We're spending way too much time in the exam room talking to patients, talking to parents about policy issues. We need the association to take that off our plate.
A lot of data show that people are increasingly using sources other than experts, scientific medical experts, for their main information about various topics. Health, science, medicine are the primary ones. They're either doing a web search and taking the AI summary and following that, or they're taking things that come out of TikTok or social media. And a lot of that is the government has taken a lot of this stuff down, but you mentioned things like vaccinations, for example. This is especially going to hit primary care, pediatrics, family medicine folks, and the associations that represent them. As an association leader, you want your members to be the preeminent sources of information and expertise and knowledge for their patients. And so your advocacy efforts also need to center on how do you give them the information they need to take, and in many cases, retake that position, that primary role? Because when parents come into an exam room with an infant and say, "I read somewhere that I really shouldn't get little Janie a vaccination. She shouldn't have as many vaccines. She might get autism. She might get this. She might get that." You certainly don't want your members, and the members themselves certainly don't want to be spending extra time trying to talk someone out of something that a parent read on TikTok or read through social media or on it through an unreliable, unsubstantiated source. So part of your advocacy efforts really need to center, and this is tied to policy, is how do you reinforce for and on behalf of your members that they are the experts for their patients, for their communities? And if you work in a hospital, if you work in an association, I've worked in both, you have people on the inside whose job it is to do that in community relations and public affairs and all that. But you need to be doing that job too on a grand scale. And what that means is it's often how you talk to people. You're moving from representing them now to interpreting and activating what's going on for them. You need to be translators of policy and economic signals. You need to tell them and show them, give them data, talking points, communication training as needed as to what that means for their day-to-day job. How do you as an association help your members prepare for and respond to folks who come in with reasonable questions about, do I want to do this? Why should I have you do that? It's not just about your members' bottom line and their practice, it's about their credibility. Your credibility is their credibility, and theirs is yours. And that's an important element. So you have to lead them. They know what the information is, but you need to give them the resources to help them be prepared for and adapt to those kinds of situations. And Mike, your question about that is just perfect. We're seeing that every day. Doctors are already spending less time with patients to begin with. That's being driven by insurers. Now, if they have to deal with questions like, "I read on this website," or "a friend sent me something on Facebook that said this," if you have to spend extra time as a doctor, a nurse, whoever, dealing with that stuff, instead of actually focusing on the relationship and the care of the patient, that's another burden you don't need or want, and it's going to affect your community. We've seen communities across this country where you don't get the rates of vaccination you need, and you're seeing outbreaks of diseases we haven't seen in decades. And that is part of the job. It's obviously the job of doctors and public health leaders to do that, but it's also the job of the organizations that represent them and service them to be part of that. And that is clearly, part of your growing role as a medical association leader in this practice. So again, it's being aware of the policy, economic, and even social issues. And I don't want to, it's not hardcore politics. You know about advocacy, and you know about local politics, and everything is local in politics, as the maxim goes. But you really have to understand what issues out there in policy and the economy and society that directly affect your service and your existence as an association, and most importantly, how you serve and provide advocacy support for your members.
What does that look like in practice, no pun intended, to medical societies?
That's the way you talk to and communicate with and on behalf of members. You don't just you, all associations will typically do legislative regulatory updates. Here's a bill in the legislature. It does this. Congress did this. Here's the latest ruling from HHS on this. That's fine. What you need to do now is go to the next level. You need to explain what these mean. You don't just report, here's what happened. You need to say, here's what happened, and this is what it might mean for your patient volume. Here's what it might mean in terms of how quickly and at what level you might be reimbursed, or what you need to do to prepare to have faster, more reliable reimbursement. Here's how the broad affordability issue in your state or through this program will affect your community and therefore your practice. And by the way, here's what's coming up next. That also helps shore up the advocacy efforts you already have in your organization and in your state and local affiliate organizations. So it helps breed a nice continuum of resources that you're providing at the association level, but it also builds that cycle of expectations for your members. They are going to be much more inclined to take your word and your advice when they see that you're giving them a heads up as to what's going on. That's one thing. Your advocacy efforts, in addition to saying, here's what this policy is going to mean, you also need to become not professional economists, but you need to understand and frame and communicate your advocacy efforts around economics. What is the impact going to be of this? You'll know. And some states are already doing it depending on their budget cycles. You're going to have a pretty good sense later this year, and certainly when these cuts go into effect, of what it's going to look like in your state and your community. If you stay up on the news in your community and you're involved in professional groups, et cetera, you're going to know what's happening. You're going to know what these effects are going to be on practices and hospitals in your community. As an association, again, working with your affiliates and your members, you need to help them understand what the changes in access and availability are going to mean for economically for them and their communities. You need to help them understand what the strain on providers, what burnout, what the inability to replace or recruit people, or higher turnover, or less talent, or access to talent, or less affordability to recruit talent in a community might mean, or what that impact might be for the broader community. You need to help them understand how funding cuts need to be offset in other places, and how that might contribute to glitches or gluts in the system and the broader stability or instability of the system. All of these things drive policy influence and policy dynamics. And again, they feed what becomes advocacy for you. These are the kinds of skills and tools you need that translate into the case studies that people hear about. And there is an old expression that money talks, but stories, human stories, really affect people. You know, I'm a researcher, and I know if you can quantify something, it's great and say it's going to cost this much. This is the effect. That's great. When you have human stories to back that up from clinicians, from patients, from community leaders to say, this is what these cuts are doing to us. Or on the positive side, this is what our collaboration at the local level of providers, institutions, social services, driven by our respective member associations, has led. We've been able to offset these budget cuts, and we've kept people's serviced, we've kept practices going, we've kept people from losing their access to healthcare and insurance. Those are great stories, and that's the kind of stuff that legislators, funders, politicians respond to. That's really important. And I think wrapped up in that is giving members tools and resources, physical tools and communications tools to adapt. How do you help them prepare for and manage those folks they've been seeing for months or years who don't show up due to affordability, due to lack of access, due to lack of transportation, due to they made the decision to buy groceries instead of pay for a copay? How do you help them adjust to the reality that they're going to have patients, the same patients they've been seeing, or the same kinds of cases or the same kind of flow, but they're going to be more chronic cases? Simply because they haven't been able to get into the system earlier, or they're paying more out of pocket, or their deductibles are higher. The deduct for people who have insurance, the deductibles are the things that are really going to hamper their access to the system. They're going to treat these as really as absolute emergency insurance policies that you don't want to use. And how do you help them navigate the constraints and the pressures of staffing and broader operations? All of this is gonna radiate down to you, because the federal government's going to put tighter constraints on payment, on access, reimbursement for that are going to translate to the state and local level, the state and local governments, which cannot operate on deficit. They have to balance their budgets. They are going to put tighter. They're going to have to put tighter administrative and bureaucratic restraints on in order to keep their budgets balanced. That's going to trickle down to providers. How do you help providers respond to this? And again, you don't have to be economists to do this. It's just a question of being aware of the broader effects and ramifications of policy, especially policy that has such significant budget and financial impact, and therefore economic impact on communities.
So brings me to my final question. What is the opportunity for medical associations in this moment?
That's what they used to call the $64,000 or $64 million question, Mike. But I think it's very positive. I really do see this as a great opportunity for associations, because if you keep doing what you've been doing in this environment, you're probably going to lose your value, and losing your value means you're probably going to lose members. So this is really about understanding what makes you valuable and essential to your members, and that means telling them there's $1 trillion of cuts coming. They're going to affect access to care. They're going to affect reimbursement. They're going to affect who's working in the market. That is going to affect who's working in your communities. We're on to that, and we want to help you respond to that. Here's what's happening. Here's what it means to you. Here's what you're going to do next, and here's how we're going to help you do that and customize it. And it's really making it about them. And if you make it about them in this environment, it's going to boost the association. And I'm sure, Mike, you know this better than I do. I'm sure everybody's been in a situation like that before. But I mean, it's really adapting to be relevant and of the greatest value in the moment. And this is an unusual moment. I mean, it is. This is the largest employment sector it's in the economy. It is the largest chunk of gross domestic product. a $5 trillion sector is significant. And when you cut $1 trillion out of most of which is part of that sector, that's not small potatoes. And so anybody who's in that sector, from the person on the ground doing the most immediate primary care out on the street, in the clinic, in the doctor's office, in the hospital, in the supermarket, wherever you're providing that care and resource across the system, to the office building where you're running an association and servicing members, you're part of this. And this is a great opportunity for leadership and dynamic response. And folks who run medical associations are talented. They know about this. They understand advocacy. They have sophisticated advocacy, legislative analysis and communications, marketing operations. This is just looking at expanding the way you think about advocacy and communications, a bit more to really focus in on what's happening in the broad economy, in the broad market, which is significant, and then finding ways to translate it and to customize it as needed to your members, where they live and how they're working, and understanding where they live, the communities they're operating in, and the pressures they're facing in those communities, is going to be, and it should already be, the essence of your role as an association leader.
Thank you, John. This has been fascinating. I wish we had all day. So it's interesting to me that medical associations, since I've been working with them, have talked about value and bringing value to their members. But what's become a larger topic right now is what's in it for the member. And this, I think, discussion really hits on that and really, I believe, makes the member understand that the association has their back. That the association understands the realities of what's going on vis-a-vis policy and the economy. I think this is incredibly valuable. Be with us next time when we talk about some practical ways to implement programs for medical associations that speak to policy and economic realities. Thanks.